Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now, finally, later than advertised, we're coming to the papers. Gents, my apologies, we've kept you waiting a while. There has been some business and some bits we needed to get to, but you're very welcome. So we have Andy McGeady here, journalist and broadcaster, part of the Under the Sticks podcast as well. And we have Shane Keegan as well, former Wexford Utes and Galway United manager, and whose columns you'll read in the Times in Online every week. Reason for the delay, we were over and back to Gibraltar. Dramatic news. We'll start with the Sunday Times main section, front page. So, John Delaney steps aside amid financial queries. That headline is across the board. What's slightly different about this story is the revelation. Mark Tighe, who's done brilliant work on this story over the last week. Well, the last month, really, but we've only known about it for the last week. John Delaney, it emerged that the FAI has been paying rent in John Delaney's house for what they say is much of the past decade. The perk was an addition to a salary of €360,000. The cash-strapped association, says Mark Tighe, has been paying €3,000 a month to rent a house for Delaney in Wicklow from broadcaster Grainne Show, I guess, since 2016. It is understood Delaney has paid benefit-in-kind tax on the value of the accommodation. So that's an extra little piece of news this afternoon. And Football Body makes new role for old boss, the role of Executive Vice President, newly created for John Delaney. The Sunday Times Sports section then inside, it's Jeff Hendrick. A rocky start, unconvincing 1-0 win over Gibraltar doesn't bode well for new manager. And then, interesting story here, which we will touch on, especially with Andy. Rugby set to make the jackal an endangered species. There's trials of new laws coming in and the jackal is going to go, it would seem, around rook time. Few other interesting rules that they're going to trial. So we'll get to that in a moment. Sunday Independent main section. ODCE, that's the Office of the Director of Corporate Enforcement, gets complaint on FAI, and beneath that, Chief Executive quits for new role. So the FAI is subject to an official complaint lodged with the Office of the Director of Corporate Enforcement, that is regarding the €100,000 bridging loan, and it seems Fine Gael TD Noel Rock lodged a complaint with the ODCE last week. The sports section. FAI could turn to Quinn in search for a new CEO. You heard there, Dan McDonald doesn't think that's likely, in all honesty. But Colin Young here, Niall Quinn last night emerged as the favourite to become new head of the FAI following the shock departure of John Delaney from the post. Beneath that, same picture of Jeff Hendrick. Jeff spares Irish blushes. God, imagine how grim a day it would be if that had finished nil all last night. A vice grip. This is the back page of the Mail on Sunday. Amid controversy, Delaney, pictured here, resigns his post as FAI CEO, only to remain on as the at the association in the role of Executive Vice President. Back page of the Sunday Mirror. John with the Wind is their headline, and a picture of Jeff Hendrick after he scored. Hendrick's the rock star in Gibraltar Gale, but even he can't save FAI chief amid cash storm. Back page of the Sun. This picture you may have seen if you're on social media or Twitter last night. It was a picture of Delaney taken on a phone at the game, and above him is VIP exit. It's very Roy Keane Saipan exit that was taken last night by various journalists, and it's here on the back page of the Sun. On the rocks is the headline, off-field upheaval overshadows a horrible start for McCarthy. McCarthy used the word horrible. If you're streaming there on Facebook, you can see that John Delaney picture a bit better. Sunday World, Mick's rocky road. Mick McCarthy admitted he hated every minute on the back page of the Sunday World as Jeff Hendrick's goal staved off a catastrophic shock of Gibraltar. Their back page. And then finally, back page of the Star on Sunday. Picture of Jeff Hendrick again. Rock in a hard place. Hendrick rides to McCarthy rescue. John Delaney's on lots of the front pages as well of those papers. There we are. Gentlemen, you picked a quiet afternoon to come on in. 14 years as CEO and it's over suddenly very quickly.
Quite a day at the office for you, I'd say, Joe. Mm. Yeah, some fun for journalists last night, I'd say, to try and get a match report filed as almost a byline, yeah, to the real controversy. Look, it's absolutely everywhere. I don't really know where we start on it, Andy. It's, I suppose, as you say, Mark Tighe, just to I suppose initially just highlight the absolutely tremendous work he's done in bringing all this to light over the last couple of weeks. Who his source is or where he's getting his information from, I don't know, but it all seems to be on the money so far, and he's really done some tremendous work.
Yeah, so front page of the Sunday Times, maybe that's the best place to start because that's the newest information that we had. The perk of his rent being paid for the guts of the last decade, in addition to his salary. It is understood Delaney paid benefit in kind tax. They go on to talk about how he was on 450 grand in 2010. This has dropped to 360,000 euro in 2012. He was said the FAI board opposed him reducing his salary on a voluntary basis because he'd worked so hard. And they rehash a lot of last week's stuff on the front page, talk about the High Court injunction failing last weekend, last Saturday. In fact, there's a full piece inside on the drama of the High Court last Saturday, which we can come to. That's on page 17, I think you
17,
have it there, Andy.
Yeah.
It's pretty dramatic stuff because the injunction happened so late last night that there was very little about it.
Yeah, and that was the thing. Like, again, Mark was obviously doing work. This article was in the wind, but then suddenly at 6 o'clock in the evening on a bank holiday weekend, they're told there will be lawyers and they're trying to get into the High Court. It is a bit of a blow-by-blow piece.
Yeah.
It is definitely what you'd have thought, that it would have been nice to get it in last week, but they came out of the court, I think I'm right in saying, 9:35 p.m. for a 10 p.m. print deadline for the Sunday paper. So they couldn't. All they could get in was what they could. And this is the detail that we were missing from last week. And it is quite good. And there is something there that from the front page we have learned again this week. So in the piece on page 17, talking about last week, it's going back over the where did this information come from bit. And Delaney's case was basically saying that this newspaper, i.e. the Sunday Times, was attempting to use documents provided to an in-camera family law case, and that represented a contempt of court.
Yeah, in-camera meaning that it can't be named subsequently.
Correct. She said that Delaney, her client, could draw a Venn diagram on the possible sources, and this led him to believe the only place both documents could have come from was the divorce case. Now, that's last week. In the front page story that Mark has today, he's saying that Joe O'Malley, a solicitor representing a lawyer who acted, so this is a lawyer representing a lawyer, who acted for Delaney's wife in the divorce cases, contacted the Sunday Times last week. O'Malley said neither his client nor Emer Delaney, former wife of the FAI chief executive, had disseminated any documents from the divorce case, and they wholly rejected any suggestion they are responsible for leaking details. Mm. So they have contacted John Delaney to say, why have you alleged this? But the big picture here is it's great work by Mark Tighe. This is the kind of journalism which, if it's in the newspapers of the Sundays, it's either very, very good sports news or very, very, very bad for whatever organisation is involved. Mm. And Mark and the Sunday Times deliver a lot of credit here.
Look, there's absolutely no doubt that the attempt to stop the story has actually escalated the story tenfold.
Correct.
Because it's, you know,
it's added a layer of intrigue about
absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. Any attempts for John Delaney to say nothing to see here has been blown apart by him taking it to court, making sure that everybody knew there was an awful lot to see here, no matter how much he disputed it then. After
added that. A layer of drama to the whole thing. Like, even this piece on page 17 talks about eventually a security guard opened the gates to the deserted four courts. In court 14, we found Delaney suited and lawyered up. By 6:30, we had read Delaney's affidavit. And on it goes. It does add...
It's a movie, isn't it?
An aspect to this, which is just John le Carré-esque, you know? That's what's going on. Judge Anthony Barr talks about his judgment, talking about how it was overwhelmingly a matter of public interest, that this seemed to be a fairly straightforward judgment on his behalf as well. So that piece goes all the way through. The ruling handed down at 9:35, 25 minutes before the newspaper's print deadline, allowed just enough time to include the story. And then at 11:22, the FAI issued a press release saying the 100 grand payment made by Delaney in April had been a bridging loan to aid cash flow. And on it goes. I just thought at the end, it's just worth remarking on, because they do highlight the general situation with the governance of the FAI in this piece. They talk about the Genesis report in 2002, which called for basic reforms to the board, such as term limits, the appointment of two independent non-executive directors. That's just never been implemented. I think people are pretty well aware of that. But when you read it in stark terms, it is worth repeating. Genesis Report 02, all the reforms they had for the board, never implemented. Instead, there's an 11-strong FAI board consisting of 7 men who served over 11 years. 2 board members are aged 79. Each has served 15 years. Delaney's been on the board 17 years. And they write his ability to control the FAI is legendary. Has spoken at about 1,700 clubs in his first 8 years as CEO. And then Niamh Brennan, a lecturer in corporate governance, said Delaney's control of the FAI was striking. From a corporate governance point of view, the standout feature of the FAI is the power and dominance of a single individual, she says. And she goes on to talk about how good corporate governance principles suggest that after 6 years, you've gone past your sell-by date. By 9 years, you've definitely gone by your sell-by date. She says a principle of corporate governance is that power should be distributed.
And yet, while none of the Genesis stuff was initially implemented, amazingly, coincidentally, we do see changes that just happen to happen on the same week as Mark's stuff coming to the fore.
Oh, yes.
Which is completely coincidental, Joe, isn't it?
Yeah. You wanted, by the way, declare an interest, which I
think...
I was just saying to you outside
that it's I'm just conscious of not being on shaky ground, but like I have applied for roles within the FAI before. I am likely to possibly apply for roles within the FAI again. So I'm very, very conscious, I suppose, of not saying anything that would potentially make me less of a candidate for any of those roles at the same time. To be honest with you, there is an element as well of being somewhat Delaney tapped out at this stage. It's coming at you 24/7 now for, what are we looking at, 8-9 days. It's something that you have to talk about. I understand that. I don't particularly enjoy talking about the politics in football. I've been in football long enough to realise that you cannot possibly get away from the politics in football.
Yeah.
But as poor and all as last night's performance was, I personally would much prefer to have come in here this morning and start talking about that performance, start talking about the brilliant things 19s had done during the week, start talking about how much I'm looking forward to heading over, leaving here and going to Tala to watch the 21s and what can Stephen Kenny do later. And instead we're talking about all this stuff, which has to be talked about, but doesn't really float my boat, I suppose, if I'm perfectly honest.
Well, thanks for declaring the interest. Your transparency is welcome here.
And by the way, if you want to write down the stuff that you don't want to say, I'll say it.
Yes.
Right. Sounds like a good double act.
Roisin Burke, page 5 of the Sunday Business Post. What's the score at the FAI is a big piece there. Just list out questions that need to be asked. These include, are there any other FAI matters being looked at by the state's corporate watchdog? What's behind the clashes with the PFAI? Was there a written agreement in respect to that 100 grand loan? Was it approved by the board? Another question, even if it was, what about more conventional credit routes, such as a bank loan? Was interest paid in what amount is another question, and on they go. What's grabbed you, Andy? You've been looking at all the coverage.
I think Tommy Conlon's got a few nice lines. We have to actually go into a sports section for that. That's in the Sunday Independent. And it's just, the intro's good. So it's talking about 7 days ago, the 100,000 that John Delaney had transferred to the FAI in April 2017 floated to the surface like a body fished from the river in a cop movie. The money was repaid to the CEO of June of the same year. No one could yet connect the dots, but everyone knew that Delaney had wanted the story buried. Mm. It's lovely imagery. So as someone who likes good writing, I like that. But there's something that struck me when I was looking across the different papers, and I thought that Wayne O'Connor's piece in the Sun, that's page 8 and 9 of the Sunday Independent News section, is quite good at giving you sort of a potted history of the Delaney reign. He starts off, he immediately launches into Saipan, says, got me as a child of Saipan. They've got some good photos across here at the top of the pages as well, so it really does give you the step-by-step of Delaney and the famous haircut all the way along. But the language that is used as to what has happened here, that really strikes me, because some we see resigned, we see quits, we see step down, some of them say move aside. We don't really know what this means. Which is quite striking when you consider of the character we're dealing with and who has all of this power and has had it for such a long time. Mm. So I will look forward to maybe some clarity being brought to this, but I don't think it's in the FAI's interest to give us clarity.
Yeah.
Certainly the timing of everything they've done so far would attest them not wanting us to know anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was saying to prove your point, I had the perfect layman, I suppose, in my wife actually saying to me this morning that she'd read 2 different pieces about John Delaney and she was confused as to whether he was gone or whether he was just gone to another role that was almost identical to the previous role. And I suppose, like Tommy's, the language Tommy uses is kind of very definitive, as if he is certainly has taken a blow and won't have as much power. I think that's yet to be proven, really, if that is the case.
Yeah, I wouldn't say across the Sunday papers in all the coverage anybody is able to answer the simple question. Does John Delaney have less power or more power now? Is he more accountable or less accountable? Is he more secure or less secure?
Yeah.
None of that's entirely obvious. The statement, the FAI statement, 1,800 words, talks about how Delaney, in his new position, is going to work in a collaborative way with the new CEO. What does that mean? Who's in charge?
Exactly.
What if the CEO and John Delaney disagree? Not every collaboration
is equal.
Smooth. Yeah. Or is equal, for sure.
The creative differences.
Yeah.
You're
and,
with
and their relationship with the board. You know, if they go to the board and say, this is happening, then does this simply happen?
Yeah.
Or is the board now stronger?
I will point to Philip Quinn in the Irish Mail on Sunday. He's a good two paragraphs here, which I think is important. He said, look, the statement, the FAI statement, says he is stepping down as chief executive after 14 years, but he's effectively stepping sideways. If he was stepping down, he'd be severing ties with the FAI. He's not.
Yeah.
Right? So that is the important thing, one. Important thing, two, is he's been given a paid position with the new title of FAI Executive Vice President. This title is significant as only presidents, vice presidents and general secretaries can serve on the UEFA Executive Committee.
Yeah.
So here's where I think Philip and other writers are going to go down this road now and say, actually, what is this creature wired to do? Really, he's been positioning himself for roles with UEFA, etc., through the last number of years. This move, it's not down, it is sideways, and even if it is a little bit diagonal, it still gives him that positioning to be able to carry that forward. And that is the real question, I think, now to the FAI, going, are they enabling bad governance by allowing him to stay in? What kind of a signal is that saying? And I want to be clear, I'm not alleging any kind of malpractice, anything like that. It's just that we don't know. This is a transparency issue from about an organisation that receives a huge amount of public funding, and we simply do not know what is happening.
Yeah, the guts of 50 million over the last decade of taxpayers' money has gone into this organisation. In that respect, how damaging is the front page of the Sunday Times main section, the rent? $3,000 a month.
It's not a good signal, is it?
No, it's incredible. When you combine it with the salary, I mean, to be in receivership of a salary of 360,000 and not be able to afford your rent would mean you've got pretty bad handle on your finances, really, I think, from a personal point of view, wouldn't it? Again, I mean, looking at grassroots level and knowing a lot of the regional development officers kind of around the country that would have dealt with over the last few years, it's a lovely round number, 36,000. I think an awful lot of them were either on 36,000 back in 2012 when they were asked to take a 10% pay cut, or some of the better paid ones had to drop down to 36,000. Right. And, you know, when you look at that being the equivalent of their CEO's rent for the year, it's you know, there's a question mark over morale maybe at grassroots level amongst some of the people employed by the FAI. And you'd imagine hearing stuff like this might be another little bit of a blow to that morale, you know?
Yeah. What about the statement, Andy, which really makes no reference to the controversy which is ongoing? Jonathan Hall Associates engaged to review the management structures, and they recommended the creation of this new role, and they want to start the process of, you know, getting the new chief executive officer. That this was all just long planned and for the betterment of Irish football, and everything's very stable. That does not tally with the timing of this. It does not tally with the new interim CEO leaving her position, which she's due to really get stuck into over the next couple of months. I think she's only due to start it properly in April, so now she's having to leave that behind and become interim CEO. As I said to Dan McDonald, if this was as planned as the statement likes to... As the statement is saying, then really, in a few months' time, you would have John Delaney and the new CEO unveiled together. I'm moving to this new role. This is why we're doing it. It's very important. Here's your new CEO. Ask all the questions you want. Here's how we're going to work together. Why would you bother having an interim CEO?
I think you're trying to entrap me into saying something I'm going to really regret.
It's probably a tough rhetorical question, but genuinely, is there any good reason to have an interim CEO here if this was long in the planning?
There would be if he had actually left. So if he was gone, yes. For him to still be there and for the story to be put forward, and we are supposed to take this at face value, that it is actually part of a grand strategic master plan, that has been in the works for ages.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was definitely going to always come out on the night of an Irish international. I mean, some people might believe it.
Yeah. And also, so the statement says that the two roles, they have to work together collaboratively.
Yeah.
So you have Ray Walsh in there with the former CEO, now executive vice president, working together collaboratively with immediate effect. You know, it's just, this doesn't ring, none of this rings true. You just have to say, like, there's no transparency here. In an 1800 word statement, there's very little.
There's been you see, this isn't the only statement they've made in the last.
Yeah, what are we up to?
That's five. Exactly. That's putting it mildly.
Right, so if you view them all together, it actually makes it even look a bit more. It's not. I'm trying to find the right word here, Joe.
The bit I am surprised.
You could argue incompetent.
I'm surprised that that he's still going to be in front of the Oireachtas. I certainly thought that would sidestepping that issue might be part of the whole thing. You know,
to pull that one would have been would have sent a very very. A strong signal, and I think they were smart not to do that.
Okay.
I think that if they were going to say no, John's now not showing up, he's not going to answer your questions.
The optics would have been too much, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So look, the end of the statement says that we're not. There's no more comments from the FAI on the horizon.
Good luck. Good luck with that one.
We'll believe it when we see it.
We'll need to know a bit more about the executive vice president role, I would think, though, specifically, won't we?
I think you'll need to know a bit more about the executive vice president role, its relationship to the former role. As in, it separate this out into things that are activities and things that are accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you'd want to essentially, if you're just doing out an organisation chart, say the matrix of what are you responsible for, what are you accountable for, and what are you actually doing, right? And you know what, lads? Let's see how different it is from the old job. And by the way, was there someone doing anything like this beforehand? You know, are these existing activities that are simply being transferred and rolled up into this new role?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, maybe they do need someone, but the kind of, you know, you can argue what you want, but the guy mix as well.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, there are certain things which John Delaney has done very well, and he knows how to get certain things done.
Absolutely.
In certain circles.
Yeah.
So there is no argument here that he might not be the man for that job.
Yeah.
It's simply the transparency issue again.
Mm.
That's what we're talking about here.
It certainly seems to be, as well as that, just looking at our interim CEO, it's quite a meteoric rise for Ray Walsh as well. I mean, I would have attended the licensing meeting with, as Galway United manager, the manager of the League of Ireland clubs is asked to attend. That was a little over 12 months ago, and I mean, that was her role at the time. To go from a role like that, by all accounts, an extremely impressive individual and very, very capable, but quite a meteoric role. And I know you discussed with Dan earlier about, you know, who are the candidates for it. She's in possession of the jersey at the moment, so she is, and you'd imagine that possibly makes her the front runner. But there are some names that I would really like to see get bounced around over the next. What's the timeline you were saying to me? Timeline for a new appointment.
June, the AGM.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the next couple of months, they're going to start interviewing very soon, apparently. Okay. Ray Walsh joined from Liberty Insurance in 2014. She was promoted to the role of Chief Operation Officer a month ago. That's what she was really due to get her teeth stuck into now, or in the next week or two. So now that's not happening. She's becoming interim CEO. But I wish to assure you, it's all part, as the FAI statement says, of a strategic plan.
Absolutely is, because that's what you do when you make announcements. You put them in a position that they can't actually take.
Who is the interim chief operation officer?
Shane, are you interviewing for that next week? Are you?
No,
valid question. If this thing's been run properly, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Who's stepping into that role? Who's chief operating officer? What names would you like to see be interviewed or be in the mix for CEO?
Yeah, I suppose on my UEFA Pro license, we spent a week over in Nyon, in Switzerland, where we spent a bit of time with Noel Mooney, who has one of the head gigs in UEFA over there. I think it's primarily a kind of a marketing role. But what an impressive guy. Extremely, right. Extremely impressive guy. He's the sort of fella you could certainly see him potentially been interested in that kind of role. Pádraig Smith, another, I think he's from Dublin, is CEO of Colorado Rapids. in the MLS and has done big, big things out there. Seems to be really, really respected. Read a couple of different pieces with him and about him over the last couple of years, and seems to be doing a fantastic job out there. Could he be a guy who might come into the picture? If you're looking outside of football altogether, but keeping it within sport, I think obviously everybody's been impressed with the kind of things Gary Keegan has done over the last couple of years. Whether he could be tempted into something that at the moment looks so messy and unstructured for a guy who's known for being incredibly structured and such a strategic thinker. But he could be, again, be potentially a really, really good fit. It's going to be interesting to see, yeah.
Yeah, it sure will. Right, well, that's, I mean, the John Delaney coverage is everywhere, certainly right across all the papers. Front page of the Sunday Times caught the attention this morning.
Yep.
And we'll park that there for the moment. We'll touch on the actual performance in it as well. And then there are plenty of other interesting pieces. We're going to take a very short break, though, and then we're back for more on the papers with Andy McGeady and Shane Keegan. Welcome back. We're reviewing the Sunday papers, Shane Keegan and Andy McGeady here in studio. So we left behind John Delaney. Nick McCarthy was asked about John Delaney in one of the papers.
Nick McCarthy was asked about John Delaney and answered the question in the way that he is certainly the only man in the world could put the sentiment across in the manner he did. So yeah, asked if it was a distraction. No. The bloke who kept telling me I'd be sacked in the morning and that I was a six-letter word beginning with W. He was particularly annoying, but apart from that, not really. I didn't realise he knew me that well, to be honest. But no, not at all, not in the slightest.
Yeah. So Mick sidestepping the whole that business with absolute ease.
Really, really well put, yeah. But look, it was very, very hard to watch, Joe, wasn't it? It wasn't fantastic. What angle you take after it, I think when you flick inside the Indo, you've got two people on the same page taking extremely different views on it. Eamon Sweeney is very, very harsh on Mick and on the performance, whereas Stephen Hunt is quite the opposite and pretty much gives Mick a free pass.
Yeah.
I don't think Eamon was particularly keen on Mick getting the job, so he's maybe coming with that already as the background, whereas Stephen actually refers to Mick in the column as the gaffer, which again will show that he'll kind of always see him as the prominent manager. So he's obviously going to feel a bit more aligned to him. But the opening paragraph of Sweeney's, hats off to Mick McCarthy. It took some talent to make you feel worse about the Irish football team after the preceding year and a half of gross underachievement, but he's done it. And it kind of continues on in the same vein where he is extremely harsh on the performance, which admittedly was very, very poor. What I will say to Eamon Sweeney is I give him certainly, if not the line of the day, one of the lines of the day, when later in the piece he says, it seems somehow fitting that their two best players, Roy and Joseph Cipollina, sound like they should be slinging buckets of water at each other in the Duffy Circus ring. I thought that was very, very good. Stephen, I would probably lean towards Stephen Hunt's take on the whole thing a little bit more. Look, absolutely horrible conditions by the looks of things, a really, really horrible pitch to be playing on.
Yeah.
No practice matches in whatsoever to try and bed things down. He got his 3 points. Let's cool the jets a little bit and see where it goes from here.
I'd be in that camp as well. I think it's a total free pass. The pitch was horrific. If there's one thing Irish people can relate to, it's playing on AstroTurf in the wind. It's miserable. You can't do anything. You're against a team that are up for it. They're used to the conditions. It's your first time playing together. You're trying out the Coleman-Doherty combination. Like, Mick's not... none of us can see into the future. You have to give it a chance in case it works. So for all those reasons, it's perfectly understandable it was messy. Look, they might have scored another two or three and suddenly the scoreline looks a lot better and you shrug and get off. But it's just such a miserable experience for the players and for us to watch. I think it's a massive free pass. Tuesday, and it was always going to, but Tuesday will define how we feel about the opening international window.
Yeah, it will. Look, what it did show is, I suppose, he is going to have some headaches that there's no obvious solution to, primarily, obviously, the Matt Doherty one. I don't think it worked. I don't think Matt Doherty was a whole pile poorer than quite a lot of other players on the field.
I thought the left-hand side was more worryingly poor than the right-hand side.
I'd agree. I'd probably agree. And therefore, that might actually, lead to Matt Doherty actually popping up on the left for us possibly next week. Again, Enda Stevens didn't do particularly poorly, but he probably didn't do enough to say, well, I'm undroppable. But then very, very few people did. But it's having been in, situations where you have two similar players or you're overloaded in one position and you have a gap in the other. Like, it's a real, real headache for him without a very, very obvious solution. a change of system where Coleman can play on the right of three and Doherty play on the right of the four in front of that would probably be the best way to get Doherty the best out of Doherty, but Coleman's never played it. Could he do it?
You're rejigging an awful lot for one player.
And you've also got to bear in mind that it's international level. You haven't got week after week to work on a new system. He's got a very, very short period of time to try and roll out something new. I don't think he'll do that. I think he'll definitely stick with the four. I would be amazed. Well, I wouldn't be amazed, but it's hard to believe that Matt Doherty could find himself not in the starting 11 for us. Like, he's having a just truly phenomenal season.
When McCarthy is calling him the best attacking, and he said it several times across several interviews, press conference, Tony O'Donoghue, when he's calling him the best attacking fullback in the Premier League, it's very hard to leave him out. I think the next logical, if you're talking process of elimination here, you have to try Doherty and Coleman in case something clicks. Now, arguably, it's tough to write it off on the basis of last night, but time is not a luxury they have. A game's not a luxury they have. I think the next obvious thing to try is Doherty at left fullback, where he has played before, and see can you get a tune out of him there. He's not going to be overlapping, whipping it in with his left foot, but let's see what he can do. This is the problem for Mick. You're down to six games after this.
Absolutely.
It's very hard to find a magic system.
You know, he didn't beat about the bush last night. Again, quoting him from the piece here, when asked if it had worked, not particularly. If he is a fullback, more often than not you're coming from behind. I said he has been the best attacking right wing back in the Premier League. That's the key phrase right wing back. So I think he's fantastic there, but maybe he's not as good as a traditional fullback or as a traditional winger, which was the bit that got me a little bit worried that he might find himself out of the side. But I don't know what the solution is. As you say, very, very strong chance that he could find himself popping up at left. We were playing with a lot of width last night, an awful, awful lot of width last night with a right winger who was going to hug the touchline, a left winger who was going to hug the touchline, and then Sean McGuire, who I'd have a vested interest in myself. It was at the complete opposite to what he needed, and he was the complete opposite to what they needed. Collins at centre forward, who's scored numerous goals with his head all year, you would have thought was possibly better suited within that system to play in the centre forward role. Sean McGuire, to me, should be an automatic pick at the moment, but you would have to probably play very, very differently if you were going to do that. He needs kind of guys floating in around behind him, playing as you know, in those kind of quarter spaces, as we would call it, where they're in areas that they can just slip him in.
Yeah. Tough when Gibraltar were so deep.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Nick also points on that in terms of Doherty. Doherty likes to get in behind somebody, you know, there was nowhere to get in behind. But there's quite a lot of work to be done. But obviously there was going to be a lot of work to be done.
I don't think we're a team that's built to break down a parking the bus kind of a job. We're just one of those technicians, really. And in that wind, on that pitch, you know.
Definitely in that wind, on that pitch, that's for sure, yeah. You would like to think we'd have a bit more creativity with, you know, a fully fit Robbie Brady maybe playing in an advanced position, Colin O'Dowda, fellas like that.
Yeah.
Alan Brown, he's not, I suppose, that kind of player, but again, in that area of the field, he would give you something a little bit different. So there's people to come back into the picture as well that should improve us.
Tell you what, Heron can whip a free kick, can't he?
Yeah, and I thought he was decent overall, to be honest. In fairness, the centre mids probably, you know, did quite well. I think they came out with their reputations reasonably intact.
The most encouraging thing was to see Jeff Hendrick gambling and getting forward and getting to the box, and he took his goal so well.
Yeah, really, really cool.
Calm, wasn't it?
Really cool, really calm. Stephen Hunt says that he thought it was a typical Mick McCarthy team style goal. He obviously been in dressing rooms with Mick. Mick obviously encourages one of the centre mids to try and make that run, and he's done it really well, and as you say, finished it so coolly, you know.
Yeah, okay. Tuesday will be interesting, both for atmosphere in the stadium. I mean, look, again, Jonathan Hall Associates have planned all this out meticulously, so who are we to argue? But you risk a dodgy atmosphere in the stadium for a crucial game for Mick McCarthy, and it'll be interesting on the pitch as well.
Let the banner making commence.
It will. Just before we move off.
Imagine the banners that will be confiscated come Tuesday.
Just before we move off it, Kieran Kennedy in the Times had a very, very good piece. He's done a clever thing here. Well, maybe everybody could hear every word Mick said, but he seems to have found himself close enough to hear what Mick is saying, which is something I would do with almost every game I go to, is try and sit close enough to the manager to hear what they're saying, be it a GAA match or a football match. During a fractured performance, McCarthy bellowed at his players to keep possession and move the ball quicker, calling for Hendrick to drop deep and get on the ball. Most of the play went down the right-hand side, but the one bit that you were saying, Mr. Delaney, has everything planned out perfectly, while watching the game, Kieran Kennedy was obviously able to keep an eye on John as well. Delaney repeatedly left his seat to take phone calls, missing the Jeff Hendrick second half goal when the deadlock was finally broken.
Yeah, a bizarre 24 hours. So that's the football. Andy, can I steer you, really interested for your thoughts on this, because I know it's an area that you're really on top of and follow. Sunday Times sports section front page, rugby set to make jackal an endangered species. I think we all know what a jackal is now, which is an amazing thing. So World Rugby's proposed law changes are looking to produce a more fluid game. This is Stephen Jones and Sam Peters, and they want to reduce the number of head-on tackles, and they want to outlaw the work of the modern-day jackal. So they want to penalise the practice of a defender, in this case the jackal, stopping the flow by getting over the ball. We've seen it so many times. Getting over the ball, playing it with his hands after the tackle, and trying to affect turnover. They also are looking at reducing the number of replacements. And then there's the 50-22 law, which we'll get onto in a moment. But this business of what they're doing around the breakdown, restoring old-fashioned rucking in a sense. Explain it to us. I think the jackal we're all fairly familiar with. It's become such a part of the lexicon of sporting talk around rugby. It is that person in a very vulnerable position. You know, knee bent at the knee, hands over the ball, head down, neck exposed, and a bunch of the other lads running and trying to smash that person out of the way.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've even talked about it on this segment before. There's so many things wrong with it, yet it is part of the game, and it's just seen as being so. And it's funny you mention the lexicon. There's probably a certain amount of people listening to this right now who are going, Jesus, more bloody rugby words and stuff, but this is what it is.
Yeah, don't worry about that.
We have the jackal. So I think these changes here that we're discussing here, we have to view them in the round. Okay, so we've got the proposition here to remove the jackal from the game, and what we're looking at here is a proposal to stop that player putting their hands on the ball and instead having to drive over the ball. Mm. That would be a return to rucking. If the ball's on the deck, can't touch it. Yeah. You can only use your feet. It also needs the player on the deck to be reffed appropriately as well. When that player is tackled, they cannot hold on to the ball. So part of the jackal arriving on the scene in terms of the world of rugby was to try and get the ball from the guy on the ground who wouldn't give it up.
Rip the ball out of his hands.
Correct. Yeah. Now the player on the ground should not have his or her hands on the ball to have to rip from them anyway. It should be placed immediately or hands off it, right? But this is the new world of rugby. Yeah. And when I say new, we're, 15 years into this?
Yeah.
But there's a number of other changes here which they're also talking about. During the week, we have had some talk about the tackle height. Again, it's been trialled already a couple of times. The 50-22 rule, which for those who haven't seen would be, it actually came out of a piece that Alan Clark, the former All-Star and Ireland hooker, did with Peter O'Reilly in the Sunday Times. And that would be if you are in your own half, if you kick the ball and it bounces in the opposition 22 and then goes to touch, you get to put it. Now, why does that seem counterintuitive? Because there's a lot of kicking in the game already. It's something that drives a lot of people crazy. This is different because it's about changing incentives. It's about changing the defending team's incentive to have 14 or 15 people spread all the way across the park and eating up all that space.
Yeah.
How do you make space? You force them to put one or two players back on the touchline at all times when you're in your own half. So that's where that comes from. I think it'd be really interesting to see them try this.
I think it's a really clever incentive.
Simple.
Yeah, because the GAA are in the midst now of trying to deal with new rules and the law of unintended consequences, and it is complicated.
Yep.
But this law just seems to incentivise to the right amount, the right extent, doesn't change the general nature of the game.
And you don't have to do it.
You don't have to do
if
it.
You want to drop back, if you want to say, listen, we think your kicker is rubbish, that's fine too.
Yeah, you'll need a great kicker, you'll need a solid line out, so you've got to win your own line out, say it's 5-10 metres from the opposition try line, but there are teams against whom you just cannot give them line outs 5-10 metres from the try line, so you'll have to leave men back, therefore more space, and you might see more running rugby as a consequence.
Potentially. And this is the thing, it's all about potential. Even if you make that defender, that those defenders think you're shaping to do that, suddenly space has appeared. So it changes the scope of what could be in front of you.
One of the arguments as well on that theme is that, so the extinction of the jackal.
Yep.
obviously they're looking at safety, but also in this piece in the Sunday Times, Stephen Jones and Sam Peters, they're writing that it will bring more players into the contact area, so leaving the field with more space in which to attack. So there's going to be more bodies on the ground, therefore less in a defensive line. The days of having one player go in at the ruck could be endangered.
And you've just gone to where I was going to bring this, which was we've seen now teams being incredibly disciplined about putting players in. So now you do have this one person ruck. And we've even seen the laws change so that the offside line is now created when the tackler goes in as opposed to when there's a ruck. And for a ruck, there needs to be a player from both sides in contact over the ball. Mm. So again, if you have multiple players needing to go in, yes, that draws more people away from that huge, big rugby league style, and I just mean that factually rather than pejoratively, of players across the pitch, again, eating up space. So it is about space, and that's when you get into this point about the number of replacements as well.
Yeah,
I'm really encouraged to see them even consider this. So we've increased, so the number of replacements you can use in our game of rugby at the elite level is up to 8, and that's actually more in France. They've been trialling this new rule where you can have players on and off. The reducing that to 6 or even 5, we will always get hit with the concern for injuries. But the counterintuitive thing about this would be, would you decrease the number of injuries and increase the space on the pitch if you reduce the number of fresh players coming in to smash their way around for 20 minutes?
Yeah.
It's something you have to take into account. For example, when you look at statistics from a rugby match, when you look at particularly a back rower who comes on with, say, 10 minutes ago, they can put on obscene number of tackles because that's all they're doing.
Yeah.
They're going around first on the scene, hit all the time.
Yeah.
Every one of those hits is something which potentially a tireder player, a more fatigued player, could not make.
Yeah, and I would suspect the front, look, it's commonplace now, clock goes 55 minutes, you're waiting for the front row to be taken off, or certainly the two props. There's probably still enough replacements allowed for that to happen, but is there the argument as well that they're trying to reduce the size of some of the players, i.e. you can't carry around so much bulk with you for the full 80 minutes. If you need to stay on, you might have to slim down a little bit.
It means you need to train for 80 minutes.
Yeah.
And not for 50. Or 40.
Yeah, not just be a beast carrying an extra 3 stone than you might otherwise.
Exactly, and then you get the new guys coming in. There's always an art for, particularly in the front rows, there used to be an art of tiring out, of working out an opponent, and then you'd get them technically by the end, or if they were tired. That changed once you had the entire new front rows come on, because you're talking about a completely, A, they're fresh, and B, you have to work out the new technique, you know? And you know what? You're probably gone as well. But there's a lot going on here with these changes. It'll be interesting to see how they're put in place. I know during the week at the World Rugby meeting in, I think it was in Marcy in France, last week, they were talking about putting some of these in place in the amateur game in France and a couple of other levels. That's how World Rugby usually does these things. You do them in tournaments, underage, amateur, record the data, see what happens. And again, sometimes it doesn't always go well. We did have a trial this year in one of the lower grade competitions in England cut short halfway through because they didn't like the data that they were seeing. They were actually seeing more incidents of injuries to the head when they tried to bring in this lower tackling rule. There's one that's not mentioned here, which is also interesting, and it is the tackle warning system. So they trialled it in the Junior World Cup a couple of years back, and these are tackles which they weren't penalised at the time, and they're not something which would be cited, but it was bad technique that could risk injury.
Right.
This is after the match, and that's very clear. It's not the TMO getting involved in the game. Mm. It's after the match you receive a report that says you use bad technique, that's potentially dangerous. And you pick up, I think it's 3 of those, then you get your sanction.
Mm.
So it's kind of a softly after the game saying this could be a learning opportunity for you, young player, and we'll see where it goes. But yeah, we'll see. Rugby is a sport which wants to change, I think, its perception. I know David Walsh, if you go to the back page.
Yeah. Have you seen the video he's talking about?
I have, yeah.
I haven't seen it.
It is worth looking up. So this is, David Walsh is writing about video footage of sickening injuries, filling parents, quote, with dread and pushing rugby closer to crisis. It is a problem.
when you have a parent looking at a big hit, a big incident in a rugby match that involves someone absolutely getting drilled, especially if it's a junior player.
This video is of an under 14 game in South Africa where I presume a slim enough number 10 gets a ball and quickly passes it on and then gets absolutely smashed by a bigger under 14s player, and then the video goes dead. You presume and hope he's okay, but it found its way to David Walsh's phone, found its way to your phone.
It's been on Twitter, yeah. Okay. David Walsh, if you look up Parle Boys, P-A-A-R-L, Boys, on Twitter, you will get the clip immediately and you'll see this. It's very short, it's about 7 or 8 seconds. And David Walsh's line here is very important. To appreciate the velocity, you need to see the video, because everything is completely normal until this hit happens. And all of a sudden, it's honestly like something out of a cartoon. Because the smaller boy gets hit, and he isn't hit in a terribly illegal way. It's not something which should be going, oh, if it was a professional match, oh, he's going to be cited, get him off. It's just the violence of the entire thing, and it's just big thing hitting small thing, and he goes over like a cartwheel. Walsh then moves on to talk about a couple of other things here. The Jamie Cudmore was talking with the Daily Mail this week about his action against Clermont Auvergne, about his care, or what he's alleging is a lack of.
Yeah.
And then also in, I think it was yesterday's Irish Times, David Walsh also references Gavin Comiskey's long piece with Killian Willis, who also had a court case with Sale. And both of those went very different directions. And then he references the piece on the front page as well. So I think both of those pieces, the piece about the law changes and David Walsh's piece about the image of rugby, probably need to be viewed in the round.
Yeah, and he mentions those deaths in France over the last year.
Yes.
A brief aside, because I want to keep things moving on, and there's a great piece that you both like about the joys of the mix zone that Jonathan Northcroft writes when you're trying to grab interviews. Briefly tangential to rugby being so on top of this issue, football, on the other hand, and you've seen it in a few headlines, when it comes to head injuries, it's like the complete opposite. It's like something from the 60s. It's talked about as a sign of bravery still.
Okay, so we'll set the scene. So Newcastle defender Fabian Schär was knocked out last night playing for Switzerland against
Georgia,
thank you. So he's knocked out. He plays on. Okay, it's not the first time we've seen that happen, but I want to highlight a headline, and I'm going to call out the Telegraph on this because it's actually symptomatic of a wider attitude towards concussion and people being KO'd in sport, right? We have moved on from this in rugby, and I'm not saying rugby's brilliant or got it sorted. I'm just saying I don't think you'd see a headline like this anymore. The headline is, Schär knocked out but then recovers to inspire Swiss. That is astonishing to me that we're now in 2019 and we see that headline, and that is mindful of an attitude that actually this is a sign of bravery. And the player, I don't think, if you see the video of this, he isn't in a position to be brave or not. He's just out. The first player that runs to him is actually an opponent with his hand up because he knows something looks terribly, terribly wrong. It is that bad, and he's allowed to play on. Now, so that's the Telegraph. What I would point to actually is a piece in The Sun. So I'll be very clear here. I don't often point to pieces in The Sun. And that's just they don't often float my boat. But they have done a good job here because they have pointed out that the regulations for handling concussion injuries are different between Euro 2020 and the FA and Premier League. So in the FA Premier League rules, they say, they've quoted here, if there is a confirmed or suspected loss of consciousness, the player must be removed from the field of play and is not allowed to return.
That's in which FA or Euros?
FA. And the Premier League.
Okay.
And Shane, you were saying it's similar.
Yep, that would be the case in the League of Ireland if it's a suspected case, because if I'm being perfectly honest again, when the physio, because as it says, you're then actually not allowed back to play for the next week if it's suspected concussion, so you would be very
under pressure. Managers don't want to lose their player 3 days later.
Absolutely. You'd be inclined to tell your physio, you can say he's groggy, you can say this and get him off. But let's be careful about what word we use, because we might lose our player for the next 7 days.
It's funny, I think it is for all the talk like the issues in rugby, and they're very significant. In some respects, having played football more so growing up, like it is more a part of the fabric of the game, because as a 10-year-old, you're looking at a size 5 coming down on you. The last thing you want to do is head this ball, but you know everyone will give out to you in the sideline if you don't. So, like, I was in midfield, so the keeper always just landed on me. That's how far I could kick it, and you have to head it. And sometimes you don't catch it in your forehead, especially when you're starting off. And you're, like, honestly, running around dazed. And the call from the sideline is, come on, get going. Get going again. So it's there, and there's clash of heads and stuff. So, like, football needs to confront this general culture of, come on, get on with it a little bit, you know?
Absolutely. I was amazed that the UEFA rulings neither say that the player has to come off, nor is there any talk of him having to miss the next few days.
So I'll just clarify that bit. So, this is coming from the Sun piece, they're saying that in the event of a suspected concussion, the referee stops the game to allow the injured player to be assessed by the team doctor. Any player suffering a head injury that requires assessment for potential concussion will only be allowed to continue playing after the assessment on specific confirmation by the team doctor, the referee, of the player's fitness to do so. So, okay, my assumption is that there isn't anything other context we're missing here, but there does seem to be a contrast in terms of the clarity of what needs to happen.
Yeah. Right?
It's worth layering something here, which is around rugby and the HIA. Something which is pointed out is that once you send, there's a body of opinion, sometimes held in the medical world, that if once you send someone from HIA, that is by definition suspected concussion.
Yeah. Right? No, nobody should pass a HIA is a strong feeling out there.
There is a strong feeling out, but they're actually, you would hear, I'm not going to name names, because I'm not certain on my ground there, but yes, there's a by definition, if you're sending someone off to have a look to see if they've had a concussion, you're by definition saying you're suspecting that they might have.
Yeah.
But look, it's one of these things which the contrast between the coverage is really, really interesting between that Sun piece and the
fair point.
Telegraph headline.
No, well spotted. So let's lighten the mood a little bit then. We're going to talk Trump and cheating at golf. Oh. Caroline Currid, there's John Green with an interesting piece on what female athletes are dealing with, and we saw that this week. And then there's Jonathan Northcroft, which you both thought was really, really good in the Sunday Times. He's talking about the mixed zones, which I've come into existence kind of from the late 90s. I've experienced a mix zone many times. It's a grim place. Jonathan Northcroft says it's demeaning, and it is. Basically, there's a barrier and a bunch of journalists begging players for interviews with their eyes more so than begging. And in the main, the players walk on by.
Hey, look, it's as enjoyable a piece as I've read in a long, long time, to be quite honest about
really
it.
Good.
As you say, you're not getting any revelations here or anything like that. It's just really, really enjoyable.
There's just loads of brilliant anecdotes.
Oh, you laugh out loud three or four times while reading the piece. So just to paint the picture, as you say at the start, he says, first things first, mixed suggests that some kind of mixing, some sort of mixing opportunity maybe even with players, managers or journos, where we are nibbling or clinking drinks. Forget that. A mix zone involves no mixing. There is a barrier behind which we, the press, stand up against metal and walk down and stand behind as the talent walks past. He then starts to give us a few different stories. You can probably jump in with a few. Personally, my own favourite one was, having talked about one or two examples involving foreigners, he says that, but British players are just as adept at fobbing us off, and here are some classic excuses. The footballer walks past, seemingly talking under phone. What a shame, lads. Would love to stop, but got to take this call.
Yeah.
Now, that is exactly what I do when in a shopping centre seeing the guy who's trying to sign you up for the Sky subscription thing or anything like that, where they're trying to grab you, pull the phone out, pretend I'm on a phone call and just head down and walk on past. So it definitely made me laugh. Of course, the trick that they pulled here was that one of the journalists had his mobile number, rang him, and the phone rings out while he's pretending that he's actually speaking on the phone.
Yeah.
But they're just all over the place. They really, really are. Do you want to throw one or two, Andy?
Yeah, I love these. I was just smiling when I was reading, and when I'm smiling reading a piece, that's when I know this is a good Sunday piece. So you talk about the World Cup. He was in the mix zone. Jonathan Northcroft was in the mix zone after Russia beat Egypt in St. Petersburg. He says, Mo Salah did not stop. He never does. But they were optimistic about speaking to a couple of the Russian players because they're at home, they're on a high. So he messaged the TV commentator, John Bradley, who covers Russian football, and he asked him, which Russians speak English? So John replied to Jonathan Northcroft with the list. Yuri Zhirkov, lovely fella, old pro, 2 years with Chelsea, the banker. John and I agreed. Yuri Julie walked past. I'm sorry, guys, but I do not speak English. He replied, in perfect English.
Artem Dzyuba was another in John's list. He was in a good mood, though, and as he walked away from us, he said something that sounded awfully like pricks. Dzyuba is 6'5" and looks as though he had just eaten Richard Dunn. We did not call him back to clarify.
Yeah.
It's just, it's great. I mean, he's even talking about Michael Ballack. He's
working
back
classic
through.
Yeah.
This is great. Michael Ballack pulled a world-class variation of the language ruse in 2002 when Leverkusen faced Liverpool and Manchester United in the Champions League. After the Liverpool game in Germany, I hung around the players' car park with another reporter and grabbed Ballack on his way back to his glistening black Audi. He was good as gold and spoke charmingly for 5 minutes. 2 weeks later, I saw him at Old Trafford. "Hi, Michael, can I have a quick word?" He smiled. "Sorry, I don't speak English." "But you spoke English 2 weeks ago, Michael." "Yes," he grinned. "But that was 2 weeks ago."
And there are some good guys in the stories. There are a few who come out shining. He talks about at Liverpool how Andy Robertson and Jeannie Wijnaldum are absolute gents.
Always
will always
polite.
Give you something. Always polite.
Yeah.
Refers to them as the Messi and Ronaldo of the mixed zones, which was very, very good. And then the hero of the piece, not a name you'd expect to come out in an article like this, is Fernandinho.
Yeah.
Who he says, "Unbelievably, I really did find this amazing. After the 2014 World Cup, which, as we remember, Brazil got absolutely annihilated 7-1, stopped for numerous interviews and gave everybody something and continued to chat away. And look, let me tell you, I haven't had to do the compulsory press conference in the League of Ireland after a defeat. Mm. Like, it's just the most horrible thing that you have to do. And to do that under those circumstances, when not compulsory, fair play to him. It's because, as I say, look, I remember doing a few. Dan in particular Dan McDonald would probably tell you of a couple of scenarios where you're just, it's the last place in the world that you want to be. And you can understand why players kind of give it a miss. I suppose, yeah. I've always been into the media sports journalism side of things myself personally. So I would kind of be going out my way to, is there something I can give you? Is there a line or two that I can give you? But I mean, why would players or managers really, by and large, feel that they need to? But some great ways of getting around it there, courtesy of Jonathan, that's for sure.
Mm. Yeah, the class of 92, by the way, he points out, were very wily. Gary Neville, the Neville brothers knew all the little secret layouts of Old Trafford, so they would always sneak out. And Ryan Giggs used to hop over the railing, which meant he only had to walk a few metres before reaching the door. And Paul Scholes said nothing to anyone except one of Fleet Street's finest, the great Pete Fitton. And the conversation used to go, "All right, Scholesy, how's your dad?" And Scholes would say, "All right." And that was about it, which is very Paul Scholes. So that's good, really good. Because no revelations, but just great anecdotes all the way through.
Yeah, it just throws out the names of Gary Cahill will talk to you at Chelsea, Mark Albright will talk to you all day long at Leicester. Just throws out lots of names that are really, really
Smalling
good.
Smalling and Herrera, the best at United now that Carrick has retired. He seemed to be very good. You and Andy kind of went for something off the beaten track here. I didn't get around to the Sunday Times magazine because it was one of the busier mornings here. But Donald Trump cheating at golf is a really long piece in the Sunday Times magazine.
It's really long. It's an extract from Rick Riley's new book called Commander and Cheat.
Okay.
So it's one of these, it's a long Sunday read. Okay, we know Donald Trump lies. We know it's well documented that he's cheated at golf. Mm-hmm. Rick Riley goes to town on just how much he cheats at golf. And for anyone who...
Because Bill Clinton had accusations thrown at him about cheating at golf and he staunchly rejected them.
Yeah.
So... Trump, I don't know, maybe there's too much evidence.
It's, well, this is Donald Trump you're talking about, but I found it great fun, but for anyone who doesn't like golf, it's a lot of stories about Donald
cheating
Trump
at golf.
Cheating,
okay.
Cheating at golf. If you do like golf, you're going to like it. But
I'll take your top few stories.
It's the concept of a gimme chip in. Right,
it's new.
I had never heard of this one. Neither had Rick Riley. And
okay.
This happened, Rick Riley, when he was playing golf against Donald Trump. Rick Riley had gone in for a five.
Yeah.
And Trump says, "Yeah, that's a gimme." And Riley was looking at Trump going, "Yeah, but it's off the green." Yeah, but, you know, you're in for a five. So that's me too. There's a newspaper four, which is a four that will look better in the newspapers the next day for Donald. And then I was interested in the motivation for Riley, because it didn't make sense to me to how do you do a book about this? But it turns out Riley's a really, he loves his golf.
And for people who love golf, it's just kind of a, it's almost a religious fervour. And it's the offence which he has taken. And not that Donald Trump has lied his way to the top of the world's political order.
Yeah, that's bad enough.
But he says, I wasn't offended as a voter, I was offended as a golfer.
It's no wonder people hate golf.
I know.
I love golf. But everyone who seems to love golf as well seems to ruin it.
I read that and it actually really annoyed me. Because I got all the way to the end of this piece and I was going, no, don't tell me that. Because now you've become the person that I don't like talking about golf. But he said, yeah, at Wingfoot Golf Course, where Trump was a member, the caddies got so used to seeing him kick his ball back into the fairway, they called him Pele. And it's he started investigating Trump's claim that he'd made in some tweet, because there's always a tweet.
Sure.
And it was attacking Mark Cuban, the billionaire basketball team owner. And he was saying, I've won 18 club championships, including this weekend. Mm. And Riley read this and going, no, you do not get to lie about this publicly. So he starts investigating the club championships. And it turns out that one of the things he already knew, because he was told off the record by Trump, whenever he opened a new golf course, he always made sure he played the first official round, and he used to call that the club championship. So he'd have the first round, and that would be that. I think that was 8 or 9 of those 18. It's interesting. It's good. It's a Sunday read, but it is in the magazine. I missed it the first time. It's good.
Okay, John Green on page 6 of the Sunday Independent wrote a piece which caught your eye. I'd sort of seen this from a distance. This story this week. I didn't know it was actually this photo that had provoked like the online nonsense. Because genuinely, it's a really cool photo. It looks like a really slick kicking action.
Yeah.
And so I hadn't put 2 and 2 together that this photo had provoked a big online trolling of this Australian
athlete.
Just
to be clear on what this photo is. This photo is the picture of Taylor Harris, who's an Aussie Rules player for Carlton. And she has this extraordinary kicking form, which involves almost a ballet leg pointed straight up in front of you.
If you kicked like this, your hamstring would come off the bone. You personally, I mean.
Yes. I wouldn't walk again for a week. That, there's like, absolutely no... And this was not a one-off.
You showed me a thing on your phone.
Exactly.
All these brilliant shots of her.
On the back
kicking
of it, somebody put together a compilation of, I think it's maybe 12 examples of her striking action. And it's just absolute perfection when it comes to form. It really, really is.
What was the tone of the trolling then?
I think the picture, basically, a lot of people were saying that it was very close to her private area, maybe was where some of the focus was been put, and which then leads to, you can just imagine the sort of comments that it leads to people coming out with. But the problem was that initially the governing body reacted by taking down the picture and just removing the picture altogether, and they said that they felt the comments underneath were degrading, and that's why they'd taken down the picture.
It's in a bit to protect her from the hassle.
The backlash then instantly was, you're allowing the trolls to win by taking down the picture of somebody performing such a fantastic physical achievement. I think she herself then also retweeted the photo saying something along the lines of, this is me at work. Here's a pic of me at work. Think about this before you're derogatory comment, animals. And everybody thought that was fantastic on their behalf, as it is, absolutely. And then they came back and said, yep, you're right, we should have just kept the photo there and removed all the remarks. So it's kind of initially talking about all of that, and then it goes into the kind of, takes it into the wider thing of talking about body image in female sport, and particularly in Ireland. You have one or two bits highlighted from it there, I think, Andy.
I've got my highlighter out. So John Green uses the Taylor Harris story and then brings it into the Daily Telegraph piece that Kate Rowan had with Monica Seles, talking about her eating disorder. And there's a good quote they had at the very start of the piece, actually. It's worth reading. It says, young ladies in tennis have always been judged on how they look, and it is still the reality. It is better than 10 and 20 years ago, but it still has a long way to go. Then you leap all the way forward in the piece to John talking about three students from a secondary school
who won a national competition, encouraged the PE Expo, to encourage teenagers to research and study PE-related topics. Mm. And the winning project is by Ashlyn Flood and Nadine O'Brien and Tara Hegarty from St. Bridgine's College in Belturbet. Was about the perception of body image and well-being in sportswomen. But the idea came to the girls, and that's what John Green says, after winning a Gaelic football final last year. They were looking at the team photo and they noticed that all of the team were wearing fake tan. That's what got the idea to do their own study on body image.
Right.
So it's just, it's one of these things where we come back to this a lot when you talk about girls playing sport and team sport. More girls drop out of sport in their teenage years than boys, as John, and the pattern continues into adulthood. The odds are more stacked against females becoming involved in sport, never mind staying in.
Mm.
So it's not really a conclusion piece. It's a, look, these are the things that are obstacles for women that, you know what, men just never have to think about.
Mm.
That's what this comes down to here. And we have a very high-profile incident, but also in the more day-to-day issues as well.
Okay. Sparked a really, really good movement in Australia by the sounds of things. He finishes off the final paragraph is, on Friday, meanwhile, Talia Harris urged people to post a video or photo of themselves kicking online, recreating her kicking style. Just something very, very simple, yeah, that you'd imagine would you know, have a decent kind of an impact on that sort of thing, you know.
Mm. Caroline Currid
fascinates me, to be honest.
Who is Caroline Currid for people who don't know?
Caroline Currid is a performance coach, I think is the phrase, rather than psychologist that I think she'd like used. Has been involved with a ridiculous amount of winning teams at this stage, and her reputation seems to grow year on year. So news came out via the Limerick Leader, the local paper down there during the week, that she was stepping away from the Limerick Hurlers, having been part of the management team that won the All-Ireland last year, obviously.
Mm.
It was her decision. John Kiely didn't hide that, said that there was absolutely no ill will towards her, and they wished her the very, very best going forward.
Dennis Walsh in this piece even speculates in the Sunday Times they may have been trying to keep her.
Oh, I'd say there's absolutely no doubt they were trying to keep her. As I say, she's barely had a team where she hasn't been successful, but I'll come back to that in just a minute, I suppose. But yeah, she's been incredibly successful. I suppose, I don't think Dennis actually mentions it in this piece, but I know she was with the Tipperary Hurlers when Liam Sheedy was last there.
Mm.
So there is, you know, possibly a chance that she could reappear there. I'm not really 100%.
Dennis mentions it. Tipperary Hurlers 2010, Dublin Footballers 2011.
Yeah. So I don't know whether Liam has tried to get her back on board or what's happening there. But, you know, there's a couple of very, very good pieces in it. And I suppose, look, again, I haven't had my own vested interest in this, in that I'm a Laois man, and for my sins, a strong Laois hurling man. And Caroline Currid was actually working parallel with Laois last year, with the Laois hurlers last year as well. Now, what I will say, it was on John Kiely's say-so. And she only came in with the Laois hurlers after the league campaign was finished, because Laois and Limerick were in the same group in the league campaign. But once they no longer kind of were due to clash or anything, he had no problem with her coming in with Laois hurlers. I'd know an awful lot of the lads on the team, and had been kind of picking their brains over the course of the year when her name kept coming up, as to, you know, what sort of a person is she, and you know, is she actually doing anything that's tangible or that you feel really makes an effect? And to a man, it's very rare that I've seen anybody in sport get praised so highly as Caroline Currid continuously seemed to get praised by every single person I spoke to. She seems to have an incredible ability to get buy-in from a group of assorted different men, who can be hard at times, at the best of times, to get buy-in from. She held sessions, I think she held five or six sessions over the course of March and April, where she looked at various different things. But one of the examples that was given was where she looked at she looked at the emotional side of things. She actually talks about doing it here at Limerick. She says, we spent a lot of time on vulnerabilities, helping these young men to talk about what was really going on for them and helping them to understand the challenges that they were facing together as a group. By the end of the season, what was happening was that lads were picking up the phone to each other to support each other. And she talks about how that, she hopes, gives them the tools, even now that she's gone, to handle things. And that rings true in the fellas that I'd been speaking to around Laois as well, who were saying that she was facilitating meetings where a group full of men, and you know, four or five men were openly crying, absolutely had no problem openly crying within the group, and that she just brought that about has been a very, very natural thing to do. And that player has been able to see other players' vulnerabilities, that does create more of a bond. And you know, you could have a young fella there who thinks that the centre forward is this absolute man mountain who has no fear or no issues whatsoever, and then for that guy to turn around and maybe be crying in front of that new 18-year-old who's only just come into the setup, talking about some of the things that he's gone through when he was younger and how hurling helped him get through those things, that inevitably is going to bring players closer together. Now, the caveat is, Carolyn Curd is known for being with Limerick last year because Limerick won the All-Ireland. Leash had a particularly poor year, even by her own standards last year. She was also working with Leash. So, look, she doesn't have a magic wand. She can't solve all ills, but it is going to be very, very interesting to see where she pops back up. And Dennis has a few decent pieces and quotes from her there within that article. It's definitely worth a look.
OK, great. It's page 9. It's a short piece, really. It's just Dennis Walsh talking about the legacy she's left at Limerick and that she's moving on. It's not an in-depth piece, but very interesting insight to the Leash work she did. Didn't realise that at all. Fellas, we're out of time. Is there anything that you want to point someone to desperately, or have we kind of covered the bones of it?
I think it's just the majority of it for me anyway. Andy, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm surprised there isn't more on the Irishness stuff. I think Shane McGrath
the only did, yeah.
Touches on him.
This is in the week of Partridge and Michael Conlon, yeah. Up the Ra has seemed to just have a hell of an explosion.
I liked the way you put that. Thanks, Joe.
Yeah. Wow. That actually wasn't intended, that one. But my thanks to you both for coming in. Shane Keegan, whose pieces you read in the Times Online. Andy McGeady, Under the Sticks podcast, a journalist and broadcaster. Thanks, fellas. Much appreciated. Thanks. We're going to take a short break, and we're over to Tommy Welsh in just a moment.